emotion is the biggest judge of a picture, I think. If you feel something when you look at it, you shouldn't dismiss it because it's got this technical fault, whatever. If you looked at it and you felt something, that's the first indication that it's a good picture.
Welcome to the She Clicks Women in Photography podcast. I'm Angela Nicholson, and I'm the founder of She Clicks, which is a community for female photographers. In these podcasts, I talk with women in the photographic industry to hear about their experiences, what drives them, and how they got to where they are now. In this episode, I'm speaking with Tracy Calder, a photographer, editor, and writer whose work has appeared in numerous consumer magazines, countless books, and exhibitions at the Photographers' Gallery and the National Portrait Gallery in London. In 2018, Tracy co-founded Close Up Photographer of the Year, a competition, blog, and newsletter celebrating close-up, macro, and micro photography. Hi, Tracy. Thank you so much for joining me today on the She Clicks Women in Photography podcast. It's really great to see you.
Thank you, Angela. It's really good to be here. I'm very excited to do this podcast.
Thank you. Now, it's funny because it occurred to me a while ago that although we've known each other for absolutely ages and we've worked on the same magazines, albeit at different times, and same projects and worked together a few times, I don't actually know how you got into photography. So I thought maybe you could start by filling me in on that.
Yeah, well, I guess like a lot of people, I got into photography through my dad, who was a really keen amateur. So he bought me my first camera as a secondhand camera, an SLR, which I still have in the cupboard somewhere, a Canon T70. And I took it home. And for some reason, I got a Frère Rocher box, filled it with fruit and spent about 3 days photographing it. And who knows why, but that was the beginning.
Okay. What age were you at that point?
Oh, probably about 10, 11, something like that.
Oh, wow. So you got started pretty early then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think really for mostly, I think I was already writing by then, and I was a very keen writer, and I like writing about art and things like that. So photography and writing have always been sort of parallel interests to me. So I think I got to a point a few years ago and I thought I really should have just picked one. And then I realized actually, no, I really like telling people stories, whether that be through pictures or whether that be through words. So I kind of accepted the fact that, yes, I'm a storyteller, whether that be through photography or writing. So I'm very happy to have those two sort of balls in the air at the same time.
Yeah, that is a really good combination, I think, especially in your role. And how did that actually lead to a career in photography?
Really, it was the writing that came first again. I got very interested in writing and looking at photographs. And then I went to work for Outdoor Photography magazine, and I was there from sort of issue one, and it's something like 300 now, and I still work for them, which seems a bit mad. But I got really, really interested in that. And then I think I just kind of slipped into the sort of magazine world, and I've never left it because I still, you know, although magazines, obviously it's hard to find good quality magazines these days, I still love them. I still love tearing pictures out. I still love sticking stuff. I mean, behind me here is a load of stuff I pasted to the wall from magazines. So I got into it through the magazine sort of editorial side of things, really, on the, you know, the photography side.
Did you ever study photography or have any formal training or anything?
I did media and cultural studies at university, and they had a kind of elective for photography. And until then, I'd kind of thought that photography was all about sort of beautiful landscapes and things like that. And then the lecturer there introduced me to sort of Richard Billingham's Raise a Laugh book, which I think is just being reissued. And suddenly this kind of light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, oh my God, photography, although I love beautiful landscapes, photography can also be something else. It can be a way of telling a story. It doesn't have to be beautiful. It can be, you know, one vessel of telling a story. So that kind of got me interested. And then from then on in that elective, it really was like a light bulb moment. And I thought, no, you know, magazines and photography, I love them both, but is there some way I could combine them? And that was the kind of beginning of it, really, I guess.
As you said, Raise a Laugh, that just brought back so many pictures into my head. I'd, you know, momentarily forgotten about that. And yeah, I remember discussing that at great length at university. I mean, it is a fantastic book. So great to hear it's being reissued.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're reissuing it, but they're also doing a kind of companion guide to it as well at the same time. So I've ordered them both. I don't think it's come out just yet. So there was that. And there was also, I don't know if you saw Simon Norfolk's For Most of It, I Have No Words, which was about sort of genocide, landscape and memory. And it was, he went and photographed all these sites where atrocities had taken place. And there was something really haunting about the pictures. And I spent an entire week's food budget at university buying this book, which I still have downstairs. And every time I look at it, I think, yeah, you know, that to me shows the power of photography and its storytelling ability.
Wow, that's quite a commitment. So it was like one pot noodle for the rest of the week.
It was like a can of beans for the week, Angela. Not even a pot noodle.
Okay. Wow. Gosh. Once you sort of started on your path, your lecturer showed you a few things that interested you, but did you develop a career plan from there? Did you have a firm idea about what you wanted to do?
I don't think I've ever had a plan, Angela, to be honest. I think I wanted to get into magazines, and I had this idea that I would be like the next, I don't know, so I'd go and work on Vogue or something. And I had did some work experience at these sort of women's magazines really early on, and I absolutely hated it, like properly hated it. I realised that this whole world was not my world. And then when I found the photography community, I thought, yeah, these are my people. I like this bunch. So that kind of got me into that area. And I think with the close-up stuff, it was just, I was always interested in close-up photography from the very beginning because I liked photographing plants and they were one of the first things that I photographed. And then I think I wrote a book about close-up in sort of 2010, something like that. And then I met this amazing lady called Rosalind Fisher. I don't know whether you've ever met her, but she's a photographer from America. And she was working on this project called The Topography of Tears. Basically, she was going through a period of grief and loss. And one day she was sitting at home sort of crying. And she suddenly wondered, like I guess creative people do, I wonder what these tears look like. You know, wonder if the tears I cry when I'm sad are different to the tears I cry when I'm happy or when I'm in pain. So she started this photographic project, recording tears on slides and photographing them under a microscope. And I saw this project, I interviewed her, and suddenly, again, another sort of light bulb went off in my head. And I thought, oh my God, you know, photography can be used for such a therapeutic purpose, and yet it can also be used to show people the world in a way they've never seen it before. And then that's when I got really into close-up and thought, actually, this could be my sort of specialisation.
What is it that you really like about close-up photography?
I think the main thing I like is it slows you down. And I think it's very tempting to go around and fire away and then come home and you've got a million pictures to look at. But with close-up, you can't rush it. And I think it takes patience, it takes perseverance, and it takes practice because it's not an easy genre. But when you get into it, you can really get into, you know, I guess we call it the flow, don't we? You can really get into a sort of creative zone in your head. And you don't notice all these things going on. I mean, I've been there and my husband has just sort of wandered off and told me, you've been sitting next to that for 2 hours, what are you doing? and you were so in the zone, you don't notice anything around you because it absolutely slows you down. It's a really mindful genre, I think, of photography. Really, you know, I think it's just a really good therapeutic form of photography. I think it really helped in the early days, 2010, etc., when around that time I really used it to sort of enhance my well-being, and it made a massive difference. So I've always loved it for that aspect, definitely.
Yeah, I guess one of the other things as well is it's so accessible, isn't it?
Oh, totally.
Because you can, like, you know, you got your Ferrero Rocher, was it fruit you put in the box?
Yeah.
You know, you could always find something to photograph, either in the kitchen or anywhere around the house.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is that people get hung up quite a lot on, and you know, when I ask people what are the main concerns you have with close-up, what do you struggle with? We get all the technical things like focusing, maximising depth of field, lighting, etc. Yes. But some people say to me, I don't know what to photograph, which just seems crazy to me, because once you get them into the kind of mindset of approaching everything as though it's a sort of the first time they've seen it, and it's a mixture of shapes, and rather than, you know, like the mouse here, instead of it being functional, it's a mixture of curves and shapes and colours. And when you get them into that kind of shift, then people realise that anything within a metre of where they're sitting right now could become an amazing close-up subject. Because like you say, it is an incredibly accessible field. So yeah, I love challenging people and saying, okay, you know, when I teach at Westdean, I say to people, okay, you're only allowed to go within sort of 2 metres or something like that. And people, first of all, people are like, well, there's nothing to photograph. And within an hour, they're still there. And then they're cross when you have to stop them. Because yeah. The more you look, the more you see. And that's what that's the value of it.
Yeah. Are they all standing there in their socks because they've taken their shoes off to photograph those and things like that?
Yeah, pens, toilets. Someone did a very interesting picture of a toilet. And also I teach close up to kids as well. I go to sort of forest schools and I teach it for kids. And it's fascinating watching what they photograph compared to the adults and how they find it very easy to slip into this sort of beginner's mind, because they are beginners and they are looking at the world as though it's a plaything rather than us, where we label things in order to kind of make sense of the world. We put labels on things, table, chair, this is what it's for. But kids don't have that. You know, a table is suddenly a den or something. So watching them photograph is really interesting, and I find it gives me real energy spending time with them and doing close up with them.
And I guess kids are, they know they're learning. They're happy to be learning about anything. They're curious and they're open about the fact that they don't know stuff, you know. Whereas I think a lot of adults feel a little bit more uncomfortable saying, I don't know how to do this, and sort of confessing that they weren't born with an innate knowledge of photography and have to work it all out. So maybe kids slip more comfortably into that.
That's absolutely true. And I think it's one of those things that kids are much more willing to make what we would class as mistakes, because that's all part of exploration for them. Whereas I guess you go through your life when you get used to being judged. And when you're a child, you don't have that. So I guess when we're doing something, we think, oh God, I hope no one saw us doing that. How embarrassing, you know, we made a mistake or whatever. But I think introducing a bit of play and also showing people your mistakes and not being afraid to say, this didn't work out, I'll do it better next time, I think is really valuable to know that mistakes are just a stepping stone into doing it right.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's quite hard for, particularly for amateur photographers, to let go of their mistakes. They sort of see, they take 100 pictures and there's one that's really great, but they keep looking at the 99. Whereas I think professional photographers are much more comfortable or have adapted to sort of saying, look at my amazing picture, and everyone, oh, wow, that's fantastic. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They don't feel the need to say, but there were 99 others that were terrible.
Well, someone messaged me the other day, and in fact, I taught a workshop last weekend and people were talking about this, and she said, I look at all these amazing pictures, and people say that about the competition as well. I look at these amazing pictures and then I feel slightly bad about my own work. And I said, well, everyone feels like that. And if I feel like that, I tend to do, I don't know whether you've probably seen it, Magnum Contact Sheets, the book, and in that, they've got obviously Henri Cartier-Bresson, Robert Capa, all the big names, and it's their contact sheet. So you can see the mistakes they made early on, even with these amazing pictures that we single out and think of them as just taking amazing shot after shot after shot. But there's a whole run-up where the action was building. There's almost a deceleration where it went off the other end. And actually, the picture they took was 1 out of 100. And the rest of them, some of them are out of focus, badly composed. You know, everybody does that. But we're not shown that from the masters. Oh, we don't see their mistakes. So a book like that, I think, is really useful. So if you ever feel, you know, daunted by someone else's work, I always turn back to that book and say, look at Henri Cartier-Bresson. Look at what he did.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. I have created a post before on She Clicks on the Facebook group with great mistakes or something like that. And it was partner and I, we realised there were no photos of us together. So wherever we went, I'd take a tripod and we'd set up a photo of the two of us together. And there was one where I set it up and I didn't set the self timer to 10 seconds. I set it to 2. So I was running and it's just basically a shot of my backside disappearing and him looking a bit puzzled. And so I posted that.
Excellent.
And then everybody was posting mistakes, you know, the things that went wrong. And I think it is important to celebrate occasionally. We make mistakes, or more often than not, we make mistakes. And there's nothing wrong with that. We've been very lucky, She Clicks, to have some exhibitions. And without fail, most of the photographers at some point say to me, I didn't think my image would even get picked to go on the website, let alone, you know, get printed and be in an exhibition. And it makes me very sad when people say, oh, I'm not going to enter the challenges because my pictures aren't as good as those ones on the wall. And I said, but everybody else thought that as well, and their images are there.
Absolutely. And I think we tend to be quite poor judges of our own work anyway. And I think we always think that everybody else is doing something better than we are, or, you know, and I've entered competitions and I'm amazed when I get somewhere and I think, oh my God, everybody's so much better than me. So I think everyone has that imposter syndrome, don't they? I mean, it's just inherent in being a human, I think.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, if you enter something, it's just nice to be a part of it. Do you know what I mean? It's nice to be like you say with the exhibition at She Clicks and stuff. It's just nice to be part of something and just entering it. Even if you don't get somewhere, it means that you're part of this, and that's wonderful. And even if you just go and look at it, you're part of this great thing that's going on of lifting each other up, which is, I guess, what we're all about, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great way of putting it. And if only the winners enter, then, you know, like 10 people enter and their images get picked, then it's not really a great celebration, is it?
Not really, no.
But if lots of people enter and 10 get picked, then it's worthwhile. So, yeah. So talking about challenges and competitions, you launched the Close-Up Photographer of the Year competition. What was it? It's in its sixth year now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 2018, I think, was when we launched it. Yeah.
Wow, fantastic. So what made you decide to launch that?
I guess it was one of those things, like I said before, is that I'd gained so much well-being through shooting close-up. And also, I'm one of those people that believes that everyone should be a lifelong learner. And every single year when people send the pictures in, I learn so much, you know, whether it be about technique or whether it be about how an animal behaves or how a plant grows. I learn so much. And I just wanted to create a space where we could all learn together and where we could celebrate close-up as a kind of a way of understanding the world, because other competitions always have categories for close-up. And obviously, you've got Nikon Small World, which is more the sort of scientific element. But there didn't seem to be a competition where we could all get in one place and say, hey, look at this field of photography. Look how amazing it is. and sharing that kind of wonder of the world. Because I've always been, I think, is it Mary Oliver has that quote about, what's it about, a good life? And it's something about, you know, find something to wonder at and then share it with other people. And that's, I guess, what the competition, what I wanted it to be about, was, okay, how can I help people tell their stories? How can we get it out in the press? How can we all join together and celebrate the field and show all these little parts of the world that someone might never have seen before, that pictures might be sitting on people's computers where they could be shown to thousands of people. I guess there's a conservation element to it as well. I wanted people to understand that while it's nice to kind of save pandas and all these bigger animals, they're also amazing insects. They're also amazing plants that no one's ever heard of that are doing, play such a huge and important role. So it was a way of celebrating that as well and being a bit more, I guess, a bit more grateful.
That's a really good point, isn't it? Because, like, you know, sometimes there'll be a dusty corner somewhere. And, oh, no, we'll clear that up. And actually, if you look, there's a cute little spider in there. I mean, not everybody likes spiders, but a lot of people do. When you start photographing them, you get pulled in with by their eyes and their little fuzzy legs.
Well, there's one. There was a photograph of a butterfly that someone had taken. And what's amazing is some of our judges are incredible. We've got such a wealth of different people. A lot of them are scientists, conservationists. So I learned so much. And there was a butterfly picture. And I said, well, what are those little things? And he said, oh, they're the hairs coming out of its eyes. And I was like, what? A butterfly's got hairy eyes. That's so weird.
Yeah.
Why? And he was like, nobody really knows. And I just thought, I love the fact that nobody really knows. And he said, maybe it's because they like to feast on poo. And maybe it's to stop them getting too close to it. I don't know. And I was like, well, I always love the things that we don't know. And there should be things we don't know. And hairy butterfly eyes is one of them.
And the theories that people come up with that might explain it, yeah. But we don't know. So you had the idea and now you're in the sixth year. But obviously, you know, it wasn't just a case of flicking a switch. How did you actually get from having the idea to launching a competition? You know, you obviously got to put a website together. You've got to have some sort of system for judging and all of that.
Yeah, goodness. I mean, I think it's one of those things that people, I think until you do it yourself, you don't quite realise how much work is involved in running a competition. I mean, you've been a judge on many big competitions, so you know that side of it. And I've been a judge on sort of Landscape Photographer of the Year, Garment Photographer of the Year, those sorts of competitions as well. So we know one side of it, but the admin side of it and the general day-to-day running of it is a huge amount of work, which I'm very lucky because my husband does a lot of that. So, because I'm not the most technical person, so... So he set up the website and I already had a good relationship with Sigma from the past. So I just basically went to Sigma at the beginning and said, I love, you know, I've been using your macro lens for 10 years. I told them a story about Rosalind and the tears. And I said, look, can you help us out? And they were so wonderful. And they said, yeah, we'll get behind that. And they're still on board with us, which is wonderful. So really, it just kind of started with that because I'm not a marketing person. I'm not a publicity person. But obviously, we have to deal with all that now. So it's very much learning on the job. But because it's such a lovely thing to do, it's something that it doesn't feel like work to me. I shouldn't really say that, but it doesn't. So it's a lot of work, but it is fun work. So it just started with me going in a bit ignorant and saying, look, we don't know what we're doing, but I think this could be good. And I'm really excited about it. Will you come on board? And people started supporting us, which was wonderful. And we've been so lucky with the support we've had, which has been great. So
I think you definitely tapped into something that people wanted because its name is... You know, it seems like it's been around for longer than 6 years, put it that way. You know, its name is quite big. Everybody recognises it and knows exactly what it is. When does it actually open for entries this year?
Well, this year is going to be May. So we're kind of at the point where we're just sort of doing the publicity for the winners of the previous one. So that's been really good. And we've had a year on year, it seems to be building. We got the BBC this year, which was one of our big aims. So that was great. So I think this one is just kind of closing up. Then we've got the results of the previous challenge, which are coming out. The shortlist will be announced at the end of the month. And the main competition, year six, will be starting in May. So that's the plan.
Exciting time. Do you have any different categories are you intending to launch, or is that under wraps for now, or are you sticking with what you've got?
We are thinking of doing an arachnids category because obviously there's a lot of spiders in the competition. So there will be a slight merging of categories. So I think we've got 11 at the moment and that's probably where we'll stay. But there may be some merging and mixing. Just as I think we've had been going long enough now to see the patterns and where people are, you know, which categories are the most popular and where we think we should split one up. So because sometimes it's very difficult if you've got a category and you're asking someone to judge a spider. If you've got, say, an animals category, you're asking someone to judge a spider against the paw of a leopard or something. It's very difficult for them to judge. You know, it's not like for like. So there are ways that we have to kind of break the categories around. And we talk to the judges about their recommendations. They've been so helpful. So there may be some jigging around, but not a huge difference.
Okay. What would you say are the biggest challenges that you've faced over the last few years putting the competition together?
That's a good question, actually. I think sometimes managing people's expectations is quite tricky. I think sometimes people think there's a huge team behind the competition and it's really just me and my husband. So, you know, obviously when we're doing publicity and things like that, people will expect a really fast response and it might be that we, you know, we can't do that. And what we'd really like to do is to do a book, but obviously the cost of producing a book is just incredible these days. So that's been our aim for a couple of years, but the more we've looked into it, the costing and everything, it's very difficult. So we're kind of looking at options around that and what we can do to get people's work out there a bit more, because part of what we wanted to do is right from the beginning, we have a lot of conservationists and obviously they want to tell their story, but sometimes even if their picture wins, they can't tell a whole story around it. They've just got a caption and that's it. So we want to find ways of me as a journalist helping people tell a whole story around the picture so they can add other pictures and make photo stories and help get their message out rather than it just being a single image. So that's my kind of aim from now on, is trying to help people to sort of add a bit of meat to that one picture and take it out into the world as a kind of package rather than just one shot.
I guess the bigger the competition gets and, you know, the more people recognise it, then the more publicity each winner or category winner will get. And so the more likely it is that their stories will get out because people want to know the background.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that has happened, I think, in the last couple of years. Like I said, with the BBC, they wanted to interview the young winner this year. And he had a really interesting story around the picture. And then obviously the newsreader was getting more interested. And I think there are... The trouble is, some of them were talking about sort of National Geographic and they've been in there before, but they were saying that there aren't many magazines and places like that left where you can tell the whole story and you can tell spread a conservation message. So I think it's looking at different outlets for that. And like you say, the more publicity they get, hopefully the more chance they'll get to tell their individual story in things like this, or, you know, podcasts, webinars and stuff where they can add a bit of meat to it. Because that's the thing. I think you're on Instagram or anything like that, you can have, you know, 100,000 followers, but they're really just clicking a heart, and the art photographers kind of want people to do more than that. So I guess it's trying to help them find a way of you know, being able to do that. That's kind of quite important to me.
Yeah, it's getting that sort of depth of engagement, like you say, more than just tapping a heart.
Yeah, and I guess one of the big things has been the judges. They're all over the world and some of them spend most of their life underwater, so it seems. So one of the challenges is, this year we wanted to do it. So I wanted to talk to everyone because it's quite interesting, because when I do one of my courses, I split people into groups and I turn them into judges and we have a set of pictures and one group's allowed to talk to each other. One group has to rate them by points and then I combine the points and then there's one person on their own. And it's really interesting teaching them how the judging process works and how there's no real amazing 100% way of doing it. It's everyone has a different method. But this year, I thought I really want all the judges to be able to talk to each other, or at least on Zoom calls. So the difference of that compared to the first year where we all did it on a point system was really interesting. But trying to get them all in one space, you know, people in Australia and people underwater and God knows what, at the same time was a bit of a logistical challenge.
Yes. Yeah, it is a bit challenging with that. I mean, there's, you know, Zoom and online calls and all that are really, really useful, but you can't get around the time zone thing.
Sadly not.
And how long does it actually take you to do the judging and actually decide the winners?
It's quite a long time. And I think that's one thing that probably frustrates people, is that there's quite a delay between the closing date and the announcement. But to be honest, I think in total, there was probably about 25 hours, something like that, of judging going on for just to cut it down. So, I mean, one thing that surprised me most was when we had about 11,700-800 entries this year. And I think the first thing I do is I go through them with my husband and we cull anything that's, you know, completely technically, you know, not right. And I have to say, that's probably about 0.01%. The standard is amazing. So the poor judges, I say, look, I've tried to cull it down, but here you go. Here's 10,000 pictures. But we do choose people for different categories and then we combine. So, you know.
And that makes sense, really, because it's a niche of photography. So you're going to entice the people in who are most into that. And they're probably more technically competent than others, I suppose. Or, you know, you're not just going to get a snapshot.
No, I think that's a really good point. I think the people who enter the competition, a lot of them already are of a certain standard. So sometimes it's quite nice when I'm judging competition almost. If I look and I think I've got 4,000 pictures to look at, it's quite nice to know, OK, I can cull 1,000 of these instantly because they're completely out of focus. But when it comes to this, it's never been that case, which is a blessing, obviously.
Yes.
But tricky.
But then you're looking at a spider compared with, what was it, a leopard's paw you were talking about. So,
yeah. And we tried to do that less and less because that is so hard. You know, I do appreciate for the judges, that's a really difficult call. I think what's interesting is we tend to see the same things that people struggle with again and again with close-up, and you see that it's sort of reflected in the entries. And it's, like I said before, it's focusing, it's lighting, it's often lighting without you know, flash, without diffusion, which looks really harsh. It's kind of, you know, not maximizing depth of field, and it's also forgetting about the background too. I think some people get so intent on getting everything sharp, they completely forget that there's, you know, there's blades of grass poking in, and obviously at close up, it isn't going to be magnified. It's going to look 10 times worse. So there's things like that. It's always the same sort of 5 or 6 points that you see coming up again and again, and over processing as well. There's a lot of over processing where people just, if they just pulled the sliders back a little bit, it would have been bang on, but they've gone too far. So you see the same, I guess, you know, common things again and again.
Yeah, it is really hard, I think, if you're relatively new to editing. You kind of like just keep pushing the slider. If you keep looking at the screen, you'll keep pushing it more and more. But what you need to do is look away and come back. And then you probably go, oh, yes. And or switch on and off the effect so you can see how far you've pushed it.
That's a really good idea. Yeah, I think switching it on and off, or coming, even just coming back to it another day, or asking someone who's not your partner or someone who's going to go, yeah, that's great. What do you want for dinner? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Switching tack slightly, you do a heck of a lot of stuff. You seem to read a lot of books, you go to lots of exhibitions, you do a lot of writing, you're running Close-Up Photographer of the Year, and you do a lot on social media too, don't you? How do you balance all of that with family life?
That is a very good question. I think I'm not the most efficient person at all. So I think, you know, I was saying to my friend the other day, who's a photographer, she seems to get so much done in a day, and I say, oh, well, I did this one thing, you know. But I think because I like it so much and because it's part of who I am, I don't ever see it as work, like I said before. So I think, you know, I'm quite happy to interview someone at 11 p.m. I'm quite happy to, you know, spend my weekend writing my newsletter or whatever it might be. You know, I enjoy it. So I think sometimes I have to remember that I do still have a child who's only 10 who would like to see me occasionally. So so I do have to balance that element as well. But I just think I enjoy it so much, and I love learning new things. And that's all of those elements, the competition, the reading, the exhibitions, meeting people, they all, you know, help me to kind of learn more about any, I'm interested in anything from art to science, and I think the competition combines a lot of the things that I love. So it's enjoyable. I guess that's the only answer I can say. Same as you. You do a hell of a lot of things.
Yeah. Well, I would say variety is the spice of life, isn't it? So if you can mix up lots of different things.
I'm in awe of you, Angela. So maybe you could tell me how you do everything, and then I
just have very long lists and try and tick things off. That's what I do.
The best way.
So you've got a 10-year-old daughter. Have you bought her first camera yet?
She has got a camera, but sadly, she's more interested in watching videos of Taylor Swift on her phone. So unfortunately, I haven't managed to instill my love of photography. But interestingly, when we do judging, she does sometimes come up. I do say to the judges, if it's a kind of weekend call, I say, sorry, my daughter might come up the stairs in a minute. And sometimes she'll join in. And she's surprisingly good. She'll point out things and everyone will go, oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. And she'll say, oh, well, I don't like the way that leg's coming into the side of the frame. And she's getting kind of the skills, which is quite nice, you know. So she's into it. But she's not interested in photography per se, unfortunately. There's time.
Well, maybe she'll get into music videos, shooting those.
Maybe I should get her a Ferrero Rocher box, Angela, and some fruit.
That would be a good start. Yes, you can't go wrong with some Ferrero Rocher. I think it's a really good time to go to 6 from SheClicks.
Great, yeah.
I've got 10 questions from SheClicks members, and I would like you to answer 6 of them, please, by picking numbers from 1 to 10. So could I have your first number, please?
Okay. Well, I'm going to go for number 1, please.
Number 1. Okay. You've interviewed many people. Which was your most memorable interview? And it could be a good one, a bad one, or an embarrassing one. That question's from Philippa.
Oh, thank you, Philippa. That's a wonderful question. I don't know. I guess my interview style is a little bit unorthodox, because I go into the kind of technical things of what people use, but I'm much more interested in the things that people have done that are embarrassing, or the things that they've done that keep them up at night, or the things. So I tend to go straight for the deep stuff. So I really love chatting to people. It doesn't matter how, you know, where they are on the scale of celebrity photographers. So I guess, I think I mentioned it in my newsletter the other week. There was, I think I interviewed Chris Steele Perkins. That was quite a long time ago. And it was when I was first starting out in interviewing, and it takes a while to kind of get in the swing of how to do it. And we were just basically went in a cafe, and he said, "Oh, let's get some cakes." And we got a whole pile of cream cakes. And basically most of the audio is just me and him eating cream cakes. And you can't, and all you can hear is the coffee machine. So it was a nightmare to transcribe, because all I could hear was just me going, "Lovely, that's delicious," all the way through. So that was quite embarrassing. But I guess the point is like, I think when you interview someone, I think sometimes if you show them that you're, you know, you tell them something vulnerable, or you tell something about yourself, then they're much more willing to offer it to you. And I'm always one of those people that my main thing is I want to keep someone's story safe and just be a kind of conduit for their story. So I'm not interested in, I don't work for a news channel, I'm interested in making someone look bad, or you know, getting something out of them they don't want to say, but I want to just have a chat. It's just always a chat. So that's the style.
Okay, that's interesting. I really enjoy chatting with people as well, but then at the end, I always sort of like, oh God, now I've got to write that up. So podcasts are perfect for me, because we can just chat away and have a nice time. But at the end, if I had to write something meaningful as a result of our conversation, I'd be really stuck.
Well, I always feel bad the stuff I leave out, you know.
Yeah, that's it. You feel like you've got to apologise. I'm sorry we didn't have time for that bit. Okay, could I have your second number then, please?
Number three, please.
Number three. Okay. Rachel says, I've really enjoyed looking at your flat lay images. Where do you get your inspiration for new photography projects? And are you still playing with flat lay photography?
Thank you, Rachel. Yeah, I think the flat lay stuff, I haven't done any for a while, but I feel the need to do one. Last week, I was sort of sniffing around the florist looking for something interesting, because I really feel like I want to get back into it again. But I guess I started that stuff in lockdown because I couldn't go anywhere. So it kind of drifted off a bit, but I really want to get back into it, because once I'm doing it, and often if I have to write something, I'll do a flat lay. And for some reason, organizing these things on the floor just make things a lot clearer in my head. So there are so many benefits to it, and ideas come from anywhere. I mean, there's a lady, I think I've mentioned her book before on one of the one of your web chats, and it was Conscious Creativity, Philippa Stanton, and she is one of those people that believes that you can find inspiration anywhere. And she once pulled the sofa cushions out and found a load of stuff down the back of her sofa and made a flat lay out of that. So I think ideas can come from anywhere, really. So I am still doing them, but I haven't done one for a while, but I am inkling to get back into it. So that's a really good question.
I'm intrigued by you say whenever you need to write something, you start by laying it all out.
Usually if I've got a deadline hanging over my head, I think, I know what I'll do. I'll get a bit of card out on the floor here in the loft, and I'll do a flat lay. And then half of me thinks, you shouldn't be doing this. You really shouldn't be doing this. You should be writing. And then by the end of doing the flat lay, somehow the beginning, the middle, the end of the article is already in my head, because organizing these shapes and things seems to bring some sort of sense. So I don't know if that's some weird way I work, but it just seems to help.
All right, I might try that one. Could I have your third number, please?
Oh, yes. Number five, please.
Okay. The Close-Up Photographer of the Year competition has a wide range of categories. Which is the most challenging to judge and why? And which is your favourite category?
The hardest for me personally is probably the plants category, because I think the standard is so, so good. But also because I love plant photography as well, I think I bring a lot of my own thoughts to it. And I think it's sometimes you have, you know, as a judge, I think we all know that we have our own preferences and we have our own style and we have the things that we like and we don't like. And I think that's the category where I have to say, you know, in my head sometimes I go, oh, no, I don't like pictures like that. And this is the one where I have to step back and say, no, I have to be, you know, ignore my own preferences and I have to judge what's there. But I say the standard is incredible for that category. And again, I think it's one of those ones that almost feels like it might need slight dividing out again, because it is our most popular category. And again, you're judging, sometimes it's quite hard to judge light for light within it. So that's probably the hardest one to judge. And I think my favourite one is the human-made category, because I really love that, you know, you'll see photographs of a bit of rust looking like an amazing painting, or obviously, you know, Rachel and her bottle images. I mean, you know, all of that, the sort of cements that looks like a painting, a Rothko painting or something. And it just shows people looking at the world in a completely different way. So I find that quite exciting.
Yeah. Okay, so question number 4, please. Which number would you like?
Oh, I'll go number 2, please.
Number 2. Your gold medal winning Plant Scars series is beautiful. And Philippa says she read about how you took yourself off for a weekend to make it. Do you have anything similar planned?
Well, I'm trying to do one big project, personal project a year. And last year's one, I'm not sure if it's worked or not. I'm still sitting on the fence with it. So I haven't shown anybody it yet. But I did spend a lot of, I think one of those things that the Plant Scars thing was so wonderful to do. Again, it was one of those really therapeutic exercises. And I would like to keep adding to that portfolio because I've been interested in the idea of kind of like these sort of shapes and hieroglyphics we can see in plants and you know, the damage created from environmental issues. So I'm still adding to that. But I do try and do a project a year. But last year's one, I think it's one of those things that I wanted it to be really good, and I wanted it to be really good too badly. So when I looked at it, I think the pictures aren't that great, but I was still hanging on thinking, I'm gonna get something out of it, I'm going to get something out of it. So I may have to let that one go first before I start the next one. So I haven't got an idea for another one, but I'm umming and ahhing as to whether the previous one is worth pursuing or not.
Right. So talk me through the process of the Plant Scars project. Did you ring fence, however long was it, a week or a weekend, and say, right, I'm going to do a project then, and really go off on your weekend and decide what that was going to be inspired wherever you were? Or did you decide what you wanted to photograph and then start planning the weekend?
Well, it was, I love the Isle of Wight anyway, and obviously I'm in Winchester, so I'm not too far. So I went on holiday there, and I'd taken one photo, which was the kind of Pac-Man photo of the Plant Scars. And I took that while we were on holiday. And then I came back and I thought, oh, actually, that's quite cool. And I remember seeing some of the other agaves there and thought, oh, maybe there's a whole way of kind of almost like showing a language of flowers. So I basically thought, right, I'm going off the weekend by myself, and I'm just going to go to the garden, and this is what I'm going to do. And because I was staying in the garden itself at Ventnor, which you can do, they will let you in before the public gets in. So I was there at like 6 in the morning, nobody around, lots of little lizards, red squirrels running about, you know, just me and my camera.
Wow.
And it was absolute heaven. And I thought, if I don't get anything out of this, it doesn't matter. I'm having a wonderful time. And I did keep getting stabbed in the head by these cacti, which was a bit irritating. But I persevered. So then as I was doing it, I thought, oh, maybe I'll get 5 or 6.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was really good fun. Yeah.
Okay, so your 5th number then, please.
I'll go 4.
Okay, is there a certain type of image you would like to see in close-up photography of the year that hasn't featured before? That question's from Penny.
Oh, thank you, Penny. That's a really good question. I don't know, really. I think we've just sort of scratched the surface with it, to be honest. I think there are so many amazing pictures. You know, this year I saw tadpoles eating a bird. I saw, you know, ants firing this acid out of their bottoms, you know, like water pistols. I saw all this incredible stuff that made me think of how much more there still is to see in this kind of field. So I don't think I know what I haven't seen there, if you know what I mean. I'm excited to see new things all the time. I mean, for a while, I did think it'd be nice to see more black and white. So I mentioned that. And then this year, we got a lot more black and white. And that was great because it's not something people tend to associate with close-up, I don't think. So, and obviously the winner was black and white this year as well. So I don't know what I want to see until someone's shown it to me. So, any, you know, I just think I want to see something that has an emotional impact, because when you're judging something, I've had people say to me, oh, well, I really love that picture, but I can't really say why. And they'll try and break it down. And I say, actually, emotion is the biggest judge of a picture, I think. If you feel something when you look at it, you shouldn't dismiss it because it's got this technical thought, whatever. If you looked at it and you felt something, that's the first indication that it's a good picture. So I guess anything that makes any of us do that, you know, is going to be good, I'd like to see. So anything that you look at it and you think, wow, there's something about that, I want to see it. I don't care what the subject is.
And the more you look at the competition, I guess, you know, look at the winners and the shortlisted images, the more you might be inspired to sort of think, oh, I could do something. You know, it just takes you in a different direction, gives you some ideas.
Yeah, I'd like to see more of the kind of human-made stuff, I guess, because with the human-made, although it's my favourite category, it's probably the least populated category. So I guess it would be nice to see some more of those, because I think that's a whole other, that's quite an area that could be expanded on.
Okay, give it a go, Penny. Okay, so your final question then, please.
Oh, I'll go 10 then, please.
Okay. You visit many art galleries and exhibitions. Was there a particular visit that inspired a photography project in 2023? That question's from Alex.
Oh, that's another really good question. I love that. Thank you, Alex. I guess the place that inspired the most last year for me was the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford.
Yeah.
And that's there permanently. You know, obviously you've probably been there, but there's something about that place. There's some sort of magic in that place that you step in it and it feels to me like there are 100 different project ideas just there. So I went round and I was like scribbling things down. I was looking at just things like the beadwork and things like the storytelling, you know, the instruments they had for sort of communicating with each other before they would write down text and things like that. All those things kind of feed into my photography, I think. So I just that space in itself, I could go there every day, I think, and stand there and come up with a new idea for a project. So I think it's wonderful. That's probably my answer to that.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good answer. I have been there, but not for a long, long time. Maybe I need to give it another visit.
Oh, I love it.
Maybe we'll have a SheClicks meetup there or something.
Yeah. That's cool. That's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for answering all those questions. It's been really great to hear from you.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's always a joy to talk to the SheClicks community. And thank you for all the work you do. I think it's wonderful. So it's a lovely, supportive group.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the SheClicks Women in Photography podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. You'll find links to Tracy's social media channels and website in the show notes. I'll be back with another episode soon, so please subscribe to the show on your favourite podcast platform and tell all your friends and followers about it. You'll also find SheClicks on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and YouTube if you search for SheClicksNet. So until next time, enjoy your photography.